Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening, and we're also happy to have back on the program once again Phil Nixon. He is an extension entomologist at the U of I, and he's the guy that from time to time is here to try to help people deal with insect pest problems around the home. It could actually be something in the house. Could also be something that's in the home landscape. Maybe it's there's something that's attacking your ornamentals, or it's going after the stuff that you have planted that you hope to eat. Any and all of that, call in, tell us what it is, give us the best description, and he will tell you what to do about it. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free, 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
I was thinking we'd talk a little bit about Japanese beetles. Around my yard, I know I'm sure I have seen the damage from the insects, but I sort of feel like that actually this year I haven't seen that many beetles. I have seen them, but it seems that the numbers of the insects are not so great, and actually the damage is not, you know, it doesn't seem – there's a few things that clearly they – like,
right,
and
right.
That is the way with them, you know.
But not every tree is brown on top.
Yeah. No. So I was kind of wondering, for this year, are we seeing a little bit lighter year for them?
Yeah, last year, for some reason, we had fewer in the Champaign-Urbana area. Now, you didn't have to get very far out of the area to find large numbers. Say, by the time you got to Mahomet, they were numerous and farther west. But And I don't really know why it was this last year, but last winter we got frost down at least 12 inches down into the ground, some places more like closer to 18, 12, 14 inches. And most of the Japanese beetle larvae, they'll go down for the winter to overwinter, and most of them don't go any deeper than 11 inches. And they can stand being frozen, but they can't stand being frozen more than 3 weeks. And last year we had frost down about 14 inches into the ground for about 6 weeks, 5 weeks. And so I was anticipating probably about a third to a quarter of what we would normally have. And you put that on top of that we had not that many last year, just right locally here, not near as many. And I was over in Springfield about a week ago, and even there, their numbers were down probably to a third or a quarter, and they had lots of them last year. So the numbers tend to be low, and we tend to put that so really many times you may not need to treat as much as you might have had before for the adult Japanese beetles. We're still recommending Carbaryl Soda 7 or Cyfluthrin, which is going to be sold as Bear Advanced Multi-Insect Killer, or Permethrin, which is going to be under 8 Insect Control and various other brand names. So those sprayed every 2 weeks will protect the plants, but really evaluate to see how much is out there before you just go out and spray without looking first.
Yeah.
Something
else that you said I think that's interesting. It makes me think of some of the conversations we've had before about how you're actually advising that people not water because they're attracted to the nicest, luscious, greenest grass. And in fact, if you're lucky, your neighbor will be watering.
Right.
And so they'll go over there. And that this year, because we've had so much rain, everything is well watered, so the insects that are there, they'll kind of spread out.
Yeah, the larval stage of a Japanese beetle is the main white grub, the most common white grub that we have, feeding on the roots of our grass, which when we get into late August and through September and into October, cause the turf to be brown, and you just pull it right up like a carpet because the roots are eaten off. And with the rainfall we've got, what will happen is in most years they're going to go to the well-watered turf. And most years that means they'll go to the irrigated lawns, just like you talked about. Mm-hmm. And I'll commonly suggest make sure your lawn looks a little browner than your neighbor's, at least a little. And they'll go to the neighbor's. This year, everything's getting watered heavily. And we're anticipating that what that'll cause them is to lay their eggs everywhere, all turf, roadsides, waterways out in the country, all sorts of places. And so they're not going to be concentrated in any one area that heavily. And so you're likely not to have damage. You'll be able to find the white grubs if you pull up the turf, but there may not be enough to cause damage. You put that those climate conditions and combine that with a smaller number of adult beetles that lay those eggs, and that really puts us in a situation to where really should be scouting to see if you're going to have white grubs before you treat. You really won't be able to tell how many grubs you're going to have until about the first week of August. They're laying the eggs right now. Takes a couple of weeks for them to hatch. You do the math. You're in early August. And so you can cut through the turf, pull it back, and then there are some quick-acting insecticides such as the main one that we look at is triclofan, which is sold as Dilox, and you can have that applied or apply it yourself. You can buy it at a garden center, and it'll kill the grubs in 3 days. Or you can, even if you get it in early August or to the middle of August, you can use some of the longer-term materials that are that you may normally use in July.
And for how much longer now will there be adults out there feeding?
They're out for about 6 weeks, so we're looking at them being – they first showed up in the Urbana area somewhere around the 23rd of June and in the Chicago metro area in northern Illinois somewhere around the 26th, 27th. And so we're looking at second week of August, end of the first week of August, yeah. Somewhere around in there.
Okay. So maybe another 3 weeks, maybe to a month.
Yeah, people will be able to find a beetle after that, but we're not looking at enough to cause any damage after about the middle of August.
All right. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's an extension entomologist with U of I and is here to take insect questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you're listening. If it would be long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. And we have several callers. And we'll start with someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about termites. So I've battled termites in a commercial building that I bought. And tell me if I'm right about this. Termites need to live in wood that has moisture. And if you solve the moisture problem, the termites will eventually have no source of moisture and will go away. Is that true?
No, that is not true, because they'll bring their own moisture from the soil up into the wood to keep it humid. You're correct. They do need 97.5% relative humidity to do well. However, they bring mud up into their areas where they're tunneling in order to create that 97.5% relative humidity. Their colony is down in the soil, and so if you're so what they're doing is they're just collecting the wood and taking it down to their colony that's underground and maybe as much as a quarter mile away or more.
Okay, so because I had a roof leak in the second floor, and mm-hmm. the termites were actually up right by the leak by the roof.
Oh, they'll prefer it, but they don't have to have it.
And so then I solved all of the leaking problems like mm-hmm. 3 or 4 years ago, and it seems like in that spot they're kind of gone.
Okay.
Would they have moved somewhere else in the building, or what do you think?
They may have. They also can abandon buildings and go somewhere else, too. Sometimes they'll just leave for no apparent reason. Colonies will die off, and so that can be a reason, or they may have found a what they consider to be a better wood source or something of this nature. We haven't really got into the psyche of termites, but what we do know that they will be in buildings, and apparently the colony stays alive, and they will just go somewhere else for reasons best known to a termite brain.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for your advice.
All right, very good.
With termites having been in a building, they need to. We would recommend that even if they feel they're not finding them, particularly for a few years, 5-7 years anyway. Annual inspections would be in line, because you can have a small termite infestation in a building still going on. It may be coming up the inside of the walls. There may not be any mud tunnels, which are usually present, commonly present on the outside foundation or the inside foundation. And it may take a couple, 3 years for that damage to be big enough to be noticed, because the damage is all internal in the wood. There's no holes to the outside. There's no sawdust. That's all being taken back to a colony. And they don't make any holes to the outside because they'll lose that humidity they're trying to reproduce. So he and others need to stay vigilant. If they've had the termites in, I would recommend annual inspections for a few years until, and then maybe spread them out every 2 or 3 years if you've gone several years and haven't found any.
Okay. Next, we'll talk to somebody in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
We've lived in our house about 25 years, and the entire time we've been here, we've had what I consider to be quite a number of centipedes, and they're absolutely my least favorite creature, I have to admit.
Oh, probably some of the things they're feeding on you would be less favorable if they weren't there.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
We have done a lot of work on the house. We've just put new siding on and things like that. We've tried to solve you know, any moisture problems and so on. But we, they're clearly love to hang out down in our sump pump well. But yeah. I just wondered what are they feeding on, and what is there that we could do that would reduce their numbers?
Okay. Well, we tend to have two types of centipedes that get in. The house centipede has very long legs. These things will be about an inch and a, the centipede itself would be about an inch and a half long, and the legs will be close to that.
Yeah.
And they run like grease lightning. They're kind
yeah.
of purplish blue. And then sometimes you get some others that are usually more of an orangish to brownish color, and they have lots of legs, but they're shorter. They still move pretty fast, but not like house centipedes.
Uh-huh.
Difference many times is the ones that are shorter leg will come in from the outside, and reducing them out of dead organic matter along the foundations, such as mulches and caulking cracks and crevices, will help keep the ones from coming in from the outside, the shorter leg ones. The long legged house centipedes are more apt to live and reproduce within the house,
uh-huh.
but they need high humidity in order to do so, or do so very well.
Uh-huh.
They are feeding on other insects and other small creatures like that. And generally, those are also, they're primarily going to be feeding on molds and mildews and need high humidities as well,
uh-huh.
which, so the bugs are feeding on are associated probably with the sump pump area, and the centipedes need a high humidity as well. Anything you can do to reduce humidity once you've checked for any types of leaks, which it sounds like you have since you've been doing some remodeling and so on, you would have picked those up. Anything you can do to reduce humidity will help a lot. But sometimes there's going to be little pockets of moisture that they're going to live in and realize that their presence means that there is some, there is some moisture there somewhere that insects are feeding on, and they're feeding on the insects that are living there associated with that. So look at them as kind of a strange, act real fast spider, and kind of put up with them some. But anything you can do to reduce humidity, running a dehumidifier in the basement, things of this nature,
uh-huh.
sealing the basement may help. And then you have to make that choice as to where do you make the trade-off from how much you pay to keep the centipedes from being a problem versus how much of a problem they really are.
Right. Well, my understanding is that water is the enemy of wood, so you would probably
right.
want the moisture problem solved anyway.
Yeah, and of course, the reason you get a musty smell in your basement is mold feeding on because you've got damp wood and damp situations.
Uh-huh.
So they all tend to come hand in hand, but on the other side of a coin, if you get into thinking about spending several thousand dollars or whatever it costs to seal a basement or so on, that puts the hassle of the centipedes maybe in a perspective that you may be able to live with.
Well, if they just stay out of the bathroom when I'm barefoot, I'd be fine. But you know.
Yeah, well, they're not. They don't want to be stepped on you anymore, and you want to step on them.
All right. Well, thank you for your help.
All right. Very good. Thank you. On again, we'll go to Frankfurt. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering, do you guys have natural deals, pest control or pest, you know, pesticide type things that I can use instead of using pesticides or...
Certainly do. If you were listening, we just mentioned one in low humidity for centipedes. That's absolutely
sure.
non-chemical.
Excellent. Well, is there a place I can go or a website I can go to get all this? What I'm looking at, like what Dave was talking about, the Japanese beetle and
uh-huh.
then some of the grubs.
Mm-hmm.
I hate using stuff. I have a dog.
Uh-huh.
And it's a puppy, actually, and she eats everything. But my problem is I don't want to put anything down on the grass now.
Right.
And I have grubs, so I'm trying to do it where I can do it naturally instead of not worry about the dog picking up something.
Well, the natural control is what we alluded to, and that is, as David and I were kind of joking before we went on, I tend to make the comment that if you want to avoid using chemicals to control grubs, you want to reduce the watering of your lawn so that it's slightly browner than your neighbor's yard, so that they go to your neighbors instead of you. And that works pretty well. The last time I watered my lawn was 1988. I have never treated for grubs.
I have watered. I got a sprinkler system, and I haven't put it on. It's just because it's so expensive out here, and everything's a gimmick, but... I haven't had to. This whole spring has been really wet. And everything that I've got out there has had a problem. Everything. My crab tree has got problems. I've got that bark beetle that everybody has for their ash trees. And, I mean, You name it. There isn't a plant in my backyard that doesn't have a problem.
Well, this year, particularly with all the moisture and rain we've had, there's a lot of leaf diseases that are out there that are kind of outside of my area of expertise. But to get to what you're really originally asking for is that we have a publication in University of Illinois Extension called Home Yard and Garden Pest Guide. And it runs about $25, and we put out a new one every 5 years or so. This one's about a year old and a year and a half old, something like that. And you can order this online by going to our Pubs Plus website. And what I found is you put Pubs Plus, PubsPlus, in your search engine, and typically University of Illinois Pubs Extension Pubs Plus site comes up first. And you can find the Home Yard and Garden Pest Guide there. You can order it. You can also purchase it at your local extension office, and that has both chemical recommendations as well as non-chemical recommendations that we feel have a good trade-off labor-wise and also control-wise. I mean, there's always a non-chemical methods of controlling an insect. However, climbing to the top of a 60-foot tree to hand-pick bugs off of leaves is not what I call practical.
Okay. No. So, thank you very much.
So, yeah, there is a source. It has, you might look at it first and say, this is full of chemicals. But if you look a little closer, there are non-chemical recommendations there as well.
All right. Other calls are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Phil Nixon. He's extension entomologist at the U of I. Every once in a while he's here, and we invite questions on dealing with insect pest problems around the home. So if you have a problem, give us a call. Back here to someone where we are in Champaign. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about fruit flies.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago, I brought home grapes from a local grocery store and left them on a counter for probably 2 or 3 hours and put them in the fridge. And since then, I have been seeing fruit flies. Everything I've brought in that's fruit or vegetable has gone into the refrigerator immediately, and I'm still seeing fruit flies. How long should they be lasting?
For them to be lasting that long, you've got another source of fruit flies in all likelihood.
Okay, so what would be another source?
Well, they're going to feed on any vegetable material or fruit material, and many times people don't think of the onions, the potatoes, even uncovered bread. These can all be sources.
In cardboard or something?
Not going to be in cardboard, but they will be in a drain that's not cleaned out very well, or a garbage disposal, or a trash compactor,
okay.
These sorts of things. Flower stems that have been sitting in a vase too long and are kind of rotting at the bottom, all of these are food sources for fruit flies.
Okay. And if there's a chance that they're in my drains, what do I do? Normally I would
clean the drains.
Baking soda in.
yeah, or clean out the drains with a drain cleaner and so on. And,
okay.
And that will take care of it. A lot of times, people that have particularly garbage disposal units, there'll be some material that'll hang around the edges of the unit or something like that. They're not getting flushed out quite right, and you'll get fruit flies living in one of those. But probably the most common one is people don't think of feeding on that bag of potatoes or onions you got sitting over there in the corner.
Okay, I'll search around. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, back here to another Champaign person. This is line 1. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I was calling because my parents have a house out in the country, and bees have been setting up beehives in the roof rafters, and this wouldn't be a problem, but there's like hundreds of thousands of bees, and it's like more of an infestation now than just like the cute bee setting up a beehive. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, what will happen is that honeybees, which are going to be amber and black banded, and about a half an inch long and kind of hairy looking, will get in and they will go in and out from an outside opening. If they establish a colony, they will end up with a lot of honey in there. Honey is their wintertime food supply. And many times we'll recommend it if the hive isn't very accessible, which is normally inside a wall void or something of that nature, we'll many times recommend that you may want to wait until spring to get rid of it. Let the bees during the wintertime eat away most of the honey so you don't have the honey left over. Because if you kill off a honeybee hive and the honey inside and comb inside the wall will be attractive to other insects, will be attractive to mice, will eventually many times melt, the beeswax will melt some, and you'll get honey running down the inside of the walls, staining the walls, coming out underneath a baseboard, all this sort of thing, and pretty soon you're looking at several thousand bucks to open up a wall and repair the wall. So many times we'll recommend waiting for that if it's truly honeybees. We can also get some types of wasps, yellow jackets, which are yellow and black, banded and also a half an inch long, many times mistaken for honeybees by general public, and they do not produce any honey, don't make a nest at overwinters. And in either case, we will many times recommend that you can kill the colony off with Carbaryl or Seven Dust. It'll be sold as Seven, S-E-V-I-N, Dust. Mm-hmm. And the dust is put around the opening where the insects are going in and out, and they'll get this on their feet and their hairs as they go in and out, groom themselves with their mouth parts, feed each other in the colony, kill off a nest in just a few days. And if it is honeybees, true honeybees, then you really need to close that off because nearby honey hives will go in and steal the honey that's left in that hive and may kill several honeybee colonies in the area accidentally. So it's important to know what insect you're really looking at. You don't have to worry about that with yellow jackets. They're not going to, they don't have any honey. That's not going to be a threat to any other, because honeybees are very beneficial in pollinating plants and producing honey. So we don't want to kill domestic hives that are in the area as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. And we are almost at our midpoint here. This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge, and our guest is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist with U of I, and occasionally he is here on the program to try to help with insect pest problems around the home. So if you have a problem, call in and tell us about it. Give us the best description so we'll know what it is, and then he can advise you on how to proceed. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess here, you know, the conversation with the last caller suggests that you really, if you possibly can, and if it takes capturing some of the insects, maybe that's the thing mm-hmm. to do, you really have to know what they are.
Right.
Because depending upon what they are, this is a good example, whether we're talking about bees or wasps, you're going to want to proceed differently. So you really have to, if you can, really know what it is that you're dealing with.
That's right. And an important thing is you can get a sample, you can take it to your local extension office, and they'll probably be able to identify it for you. If they can't identify it, they'll contact me in one way or another. So we have a distance diagnostic system that they can actually photograph the insect, and then it moves electronically through a hierarchy of people to identify it. If I'm where it's where a buck stops, if nobody else knows it, and for the entire state, and so that will help to a great extent. Digital photographs many times are helpful that way in today's situation, but knowing what you have makes a big difference, because for instance in this case, with a large number of this early, chances are it is honeybees, but you have to be very careful about what you're doing. Yellow jackets start out as a single female in the spring and kind of build up. And right, if you're very observant, you'll start notice the activity about now, but more commonly in about 3 weeks, people will start really noticing them showing up and coming into houses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we have a full bank of callers here now. We'll get them in the order they came in, and we'll start in next here with someone in Urbana and on line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with the little tiny ants. I guess they call them fire ants. I don't know what they call them.
I don't think they call them fire ants. If they do, we got a major problem in the state. They occur in the southern U.S., but there are various small ants, eighth of an inch or smaller, that will come in. Most of them come from outside colonies. Some will nest inside the house. We have 90 different kinds of ants in Illinois, so there is more than just the big ant, a little ant, a black ant, a red ant, and a yellow ant. There's a whole lot more than that. But at any rate, normally what we recommend for control are baits inside where you have the ants coming in. And the most effective one is going to be called combat ant bait, and it will have a fipronil insecticide in it. It's not the insecticide that's the most important. It's the bait, and this is a very high-quality bait that will attract protein feeding ants, that is, ones that are going after grease and this sort of thing. If that doesn't seem to work, then we recommend switching to a sweet bait, which is going to be the most common. The two most effective and common ones are Terro, T-E-R-R-O, and Grant's ant bait, just like General Grant, G-R-A-N-T, ant bait. And these have a sweet base to them and will be attractive at other times of year. Depending on the time of year and what the ant colony is doing, they may be building up their colony, feeding larvae, which means they'll go after the combat bait, or they may have all kinds of plenty of adults and don't need a whole lot more larvae than they'll be after sweets, because that's what the adults feed on.
Because I have them by, you know, they'll attack a little bit of food if something falls on the floor and I mm-hmm. don't see it, and I don't sweep up that night or something like
yeah.
that, and they'll come in and there they are,
yeah,
thousands of them, and I it's just a big pain. Yeah, I've been mopping and keeping things clean like that. I've tried the baits in the past, but they didn't seem to work. Didn't get rid of them, that's for sure.
Well, there is a variety. There's differences in various baits, and these all work on the idea that the colony will be killed off. It's an important thing to remember that ants are exceedingly ubiquitous outside, and even though you may get control on a particular colony, it's not long before another colony figures out a way in and finds a way in. So at many times, you may not have killed off the entire colony, or it may be another colony that's coming in and looking for food. So sometimes people will say, well, it worked for 3 weeks, but then they came back. Well, it's probably a different colony, or it may be that the colony has recovered from mostly being killed off. A lot of it depends on however many other sources of food the colony is using and things as to whether they got enough bait to kill them. But the combat ant bait and the taro and the grants are the best ones. Many of these will come in little bait trays, self-contained bait units that you follow label directions. Just put it where you're seeing the ants along the edges of things, and they will feed on it and take it back, and the numbers will greatly reduce or eliminate.
So the best bet is just leave them out.
Yes. Well, put them out when you have them. We don't ever recommend just putting insecticide out and leaving it there forever. But once you see the ants, then you can put out the baits at that time. And when the ants disappear, you should pick up the baits and get rid of them.
All right. Thank you very
good.
Mm-hmm.
We'll continue here. And our next caller is someone who is listening in Champaign. And this is line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I'm sorry if I'm repeating. I missed the first part of your program. I've been having trouble with flies in my driveway, which is near the back door, and then they get in the house.
Chances, these are just look like house flies?
Yes.
Chances are what's happening is that they may be, usually this is a problem when it's very, very hot outside and they're looking for a cool place, or it's very dry outside and they're looking for some moisture. It's neither real hot nor very dry. So, that would be unusual this year for that to be occurring. It may be just that there may be something that's inside the house that is somewhat attractive to them. And sometimes some of the things that we have, there may be something, they primarily are going to go after something that's rotting. But what we consider to be ripe, some flies will look at as being rotting. So you may want to look around and see if there's something that's got an odor to it or something like that that they might be attracted to. It's difficult to say why they would be doing it with the weather we've been having recently. It's not been the weather where they would normally be attracted into a house.
What about eliminating them from the driveway?
That's going to be almost impossible, because the control of flies primarily involves figuring out where it is that they're reproducing, and that's probably going to be, it can be a, could be a, just a pile of debris that's rotting away, grass clippings in one type of fly, could be manure in another type of fly, could be dead animals in another type of fly. And these may be as much as several miles away.
Thank you.
So it's very, very difficult to I'm going to eliminate them on the driveway. That's they're sitting there probably because for some reason they're attracted to that particular area. So if you can figure out what it is that they might be attracted to, if you've got with all the rain we've been having, if you've got some bark mulch or something that's fairly deep and maybe is rotting and providing a source for the larvae to develop, things of that nature could be a possible source. It's hard to say over the phone what might be the situation.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And again, our next caller would be someone in Urbana and line number 3. Hello.
Aloha, gentlemen.
Yeah.
When I was in Florida not too long ago, excuse me, we had a very bad problem with ticks in our yard. We just couldn't get rid of them. And we finally ran into a product that had nematodes.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is they were just little creatures that liked some tasty part of the tick, and once that the ticks were gone, then they just died off for lack of food.
Right.
My question is, why, if they're so effective, why don't we see more of them?
Well, they're effective primarily. The thing that nematodes are very tiny, at the edge of being microscopic worms. And what they do is that they tunnel in, they enter through various openings on the tick. Once they get inside, they regurgitate bacteria that will cause problems to the tick and kill it. One of the problems that you have with trying to use these nematodes is that they are very susceptible to drying out, and they work very, very well in a high humidity, high moisture situation, which is generally the case in coastal Florida. But if you were in the center of Florida, not so much. And also it would have something to do in the year. For instance, right now, this year and last year, we've had overabundance of rainfall, and you would probably get much better control than you would in many other cases. The other thing is that generally ticks are not as numerous as it gets drier because the ticks are susceptible to drying out. So the nematodes are effective when they're used in these situations. You also apply them at a much higher rate than what would normally exist in nature, and so they don't have much of a carryover effect in most cases. You use them kind of like a biological insecticide, and because they're alive creatures, you kind of have to order them when you're going to apply them. You'll have to apply them within 48 hours when you get them, typically, and so it's more of a hassle than probably going down and buying an insecticide.
Okay. Well, hope that gets at the question of the caller. We'll just keep going. Our next person here is in Robinson, and that's line 4, the toll-free line. Hello. Yeah.
Hi. I'm calling about the Japanese beetles you started the program with, and I don't know what they look like, but I have something that's swarming in my front yard around the evergreen trees and just everywhere. When I looked outside and saw them, at first I thought they were bumblebees or some large bee, but when I got out there, they're beetles. And they're green, and they're probably a half an inch to three-quarters of an inch long, and they don't bother me when I'm out there working. But are these Japanese beetles?
Well, we have a couple beetles that are fairly prevalent right now, and they're close relatives of each other. One is a Japanese beetle, which will be 3/8 to a half an inch long, metallic green in color, and have coppery wing covers. And you'll see those sitting up in the sun on plants, feeding on the leaves, and their leaves may be getting lacy looking and so on. Typically, they don't feed on evergreens, but they will be feeding on other plants that might be nearby. the other insect that we tend to have a lot of right now is green June beetle. And green June beetle are about an inch long, and they're not going to be really interested much in feeding on the leaves of various types of plants. If you happen to be fortunate enough to have some peaches, I don't think anybody in this part of the state does, due to the cold weather last year, they will feed on those ripening fruit. But they are actually, both of them, the larval stage is a white grub. The Japanese beetle feeds on the roots of grasses. The green June beetle feeds on dead grass and normally is going to be associated with piles of grass clippings and things of that nature, or a very thatchy lawn, and feeding on the dead grass associated with that. And these large beetles, both of these will fly and sound kind of like a bumblebee, with the with the green June beetle being twice the size of a Japanese beetle. Obviously, it's much more obvious. Usually there's fewer of them. And another way of telling the green June beetle is they tend to have a habit of flying into you.
Well, they do that.
They will seem to actually be attracted to upright objects to bash their head into. I don't quite know if that gets them high or what. But at any rate, they tend to do this. And so they will be around. I think you probably got green June beetles. They'll just be all green all over with just some slight yellow stripes down the side, which usually aren't noticed by the average person. And they'll be around for, they're not going to cause any serious problem except flying into you. They're going to be active primarily when it's real sunny. If they really bother you, just try to avoid being out in the sunniest part of the day. And they will, and they'll disappear after 3 weeks or so.
Okay. Well, they really don't bother me. They do kind of stay in the grass. Especially in the evenings, my dog loves them, you know, goes out there and digs and finds all these things, you know. But I thank you very, very much.
Okay.
Very good. Thank
Bye.
You for the call. And we're moving into about our last 10, 12 minutes. Phil Nixon is the guest on the program. He is an extension entomologist at U of I, and every once in a while is here. And we just open things up and say, well, if you have insect pest problems, give us a call and Phil can advise you on what to do. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next we'll come back here to someone in Champaign. Line number one, hello.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good.
Good. I've got a question about bumblebees. I've got a large maple at my front entrance. Now, I don't want to eradicate them, but I just would like for them to be away from the front entrance there. They're causing a bit of a problem. Is there any type of thing that I can use to get them to move somewhere else?
Well, bumblebees, excuse me, bumblebees are going to live in the soil. They have a nest that's underground. They usually take over an old rodent burrow, a mouse nest, if you will, and will normally make a colony there. And you can kill off the nest associated with that, but otherwise, the bumblebees are going to be feeding their larvae on nectar. They're going to make their own honey like honeybees do, but not near as much of it, and also pollen. And so they're going to be attracted to flowering plants. And so the more flowering plants you have, the more bumblebees you'll have around an entryway. Most people like to put flowering plants next to the entryway so they tend to go hand in hand. But that would be a factor. Otherwise, they may also, your maple tree could possibly, or other plant there, could possibly have some aphids or sucking insects, which will be putting out large amounts of concentrated tree sap out of their back end, and that will also be attracted to the bees. So there's a variety of reasons why they might be there. Chances are, if they're buzzing around, it's probably more than anything that that you may have some fairly high nectar and pollen-producing flowers that are in bloom right there, and that may be more it than anything else.
Oh, okay. So really there's no...
If you like the flowers, you got to put up with the bees. If the bees are a real problem, get rid of the flowers.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Explain that to the
one. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's going to go over like a lead balloon. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for your help.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll go on, dear, to Bloomington, Illinois, line number three. Hello. Carl there in Bloomington at line three? Well, okay. How about we'll try Charleston and line four? Hello.
Hi. I'd like to store some firewood inside my barn.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard that can attract termites. And I heard you talking about termite behavior earlier, and I'm just wondering if there's something you can suggest that would make it safer to store the firewood in the barn.
Well, termites are going to be attracted. They're attracted more than anything else to moisture and to rotting wood. If you put a firewood pile on the soil, you've got rotting wood many times associated with moisture. So storing it in your barn, you should put it up off of the ground so that it's so that there's some air space, so that the bottom logs are not going to be rotting next to the soil or whatever the floor is of a barn. And if you can have it in such a way that you can kind of keep your eye on it and look for signs of mud tunnels that are anywhere from the size of a pencil to the size of your finger running up into it, that's a clue that you're getting termites. But generally, if you can keep the firewood dry and elevate it up off the ground, even just a couple inches, is a good way to store firewood. Just one reason why we never recommend that you store firewood next to your house, particularly with logs laying against a house, because essentially that firewood makes a bridge for the termites to get right into your house.
Okay. I have another quick question. I am interested in using a pyrethrin spray.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know, do I have to spray that directly on the insects for it to be effective, or is there some residual effect?
It depends which you're using. Pyrethrin itself, the organic material, which is originally come from chrysanthemum blossoms, this material is relatively short-lived. It usually has a synergist, piperonil butoxide, or some other chemical with it that helps kill the insects, just knock them down. But that material is normally going to be effective for only a day or two. But there are pyrethroids, which they've looked at the natural pyrethrin and chemically, artificially have made other materials which are much longer lasting and are more effective in killing the insects than the natural pyrethrins are. The natural pyrethrins have been used for probably 4,000 to 5,000 years by people to control insects. The pyrethroids are the last 50 years. And so those materials are available as well, such things as permethrin, cyfluthrin, deltamethrin, bifenthrin. These are all products that are fairly easily obtained in homeowner-type packaging, and they will normally give you 2 to 4 weeks of control, sometimes 6 weeks, depending on the pyrethroid you purchase.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. And we just keep going. Next caller is in Champaign, I think, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I have a question related to bed bugs.
Mm-hmm.
I live in an apartment in Champaign, and we have a bed bug problem.
Okay.
We've had the whole apartment sprayed a couple of times with Suspend, which is a growth inhibitor, I guess. And we have washed everything. We've washed all of our clothing. We wash it in hot water. We dry it on high. And we've had the mattress steam cleaned and the sofa steam cleaned. And, you know, we've really tried to be proactive about this, but we're still having a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They keep coming back. We have diatomaceous earth sprinkled out everywhere for them to walk over, which has worked, but it's still not taking care of the problem.
I understand.
I don't really know what else we can do.
Okay, there's a couple things that are involved here. One is that is the building doing anything on around your apartment? In other words, generally, what's normally assumed is that when bed bugs are in a particular room, they're going to be in the room above it, below it, and on all sides of it as well. And so, if they're not doing anything to adjoining apartments, apartment above you, apartment below you, that may be a source for the bed bugs coming back to you, and they're probably attacking the people in those adjoining apartments as well. And so really, many times to get good bed bug control, the building has to take some action as well and at least get some cooperation of the residents that are around you. The other thing is that a thing that can really hurt on controlling bed bugs that an individual can do is making sure that clutter is at an absolute minimum, because they like to hide in cracks and crevices. And I hear a lot of complaints from pest control companies, exterminators, if you will, that I'd love to help these people, but until they get rid of their clutter, there's not much I can do. And I'm sure you've crossed that bridge, but I'm letting other people know that as well, that keeping things, keeping clutter to a minimum so that areas can be treated and the only cracks and crevices that the bed bugs can inhabit are ones that they can treat and not in other materials that are sitting around. That makes a big difference. But probably central to your concern is that if they're not treating the areas outside of your apartment, then that's maybe a reservoir that's coming back in and attacking. Plus, realize that bed bug control normally takes at least 6 months to get rid of them. It's not a one-shot or even a two-shot deal.
Okay. All right. Is Suspend the pesticide that you would recommend the pest control person use, or would you use a combination of, say, the growth inhibitor and an ovicide or something?
What you want to do is do as much as various things as possible. And the problem that we have is with bed bugs in this country, there are bed bugs in various parts of this country that are resistant to every insecticide that's labeled for bed bugs. Okay? Suspend is a quality product. A material that's sold as Phantom is probably a little bit better. It's only been found to have resistance in just a couple places. Suspend a little more than that. And then, but so what you're looking at is a program where you're looking at treating a larger area. You're looking at reducing clutter. You're looking at using the insecticides, but also as many of those other things you're talking about, I'd be looking at enclosing the mattress in a something like a protect a bed sack or something similar, so that the bed bugs can't get in around the mattress and hide there. And the box springs, particularly the box springs, is where they like to hide. And then also steam treatment is effective as well. It's got to be done properly and slowly, and that costs money. And so as well as some places, cold is used, but more commonly steam and heat is used to help control. The thing is that we don't have anything which is a good knockout punch for bed bugs that we've got labeled for it. And so we're having to use several things that work fairly well, but you got to use them all together to get a knockout punch. Understand?
Okay, yes.
So you can't rely on, well, if they sprayed, we got it taken care of. You got to be looking at enclosing the bed. You got to look at clutter. In fact, they've even come up with some materials now that actually fit underneath a bedpost that act as little tiny moats, such that when the bed bugs try to come to your bed, they get killed on the way to your bed. And those are available, to my knowledge, only through professional pest control people. But, even things that sound a little strange, if they're recommending it, I try to accept it and go with it, because you need all the weapons you can get to knock these guys out.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks for your help.
All right. Good luck. Let's go. We got at least one more person here, I think. Line number two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'm back to the pesticides or things that could be used on edibles. Mm-hmm. I have cilantro that has aphids on it, and I'm just standing here picking them off and picking them off, and I just can't seem to get rid of them. And these are very small plants. Do I need to just put them outside so the wasps can eat them, or?
That would be one way to do it. You will be able to, if you can take them outside and hose them off, support their stems well so you don't break them to the ground, but hose them off with strong streams of water will knock the aphids off. And an interesting thing about aphids is when you knock them off, usually the beak is still hanging in the plant, which means that aphid's going to die, okay? So if you wash them off or knock them off or pick them off or whatever, you're actually killed the aphid in the process of removing from the plant because it probably couldn't get its beak out fast enough, and you've broken off its mouth parts, which may be a hard way to die, but it was eating your cilantro. Insecticide wise, we have very little for most herbs because people don't. You have to get them registered and labeled for each individual herb, and there's such a small market that they don't bother. Generally, about the only thing that's going to have a broad enough label statement that will work on, that you can use on herbs, are going to be insecticidal soap and natural pyrethrin, which is the one I just said doesn't last very long but will kill on contact. And usually a natural pyrethrin is going to be sold as maybe a common one that's around is Ortho tomato and vegetable spray. It has natural pyrethrin in it and will have a light enough label you can use it. And an insecticidal soap is commonly available. But just strong jets of water will do a lot to help get rid of them. And moving them outside to where the parasitic wasps and ladybugs can find them will also help.
Okay, so the insecticidal soaps do work, though?
Yes, they do.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. Well, we have a couple minutes left here. We don't have any callers right at the moment. We talked about Japanese beetles. I think when you came in, you said one other thing maybe we could talk a little bit would be bagworms.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is this is the ideal time to treat for bagworms right now in central and northern Illinois and so on. You're looking at bagworms that are about a half an inch or so. Some of them are getting up to 3/4 inch long. They're very spotty. You want to check if you've had bagworm problems before. Look before you spray because they may not be there this year, but they are spotty and around and fairly common. We recommend Bacillus thuringiensis kirstaki to control those. BTK, which you're going to buy as Dipel, Thuricide, and other brand names, but it's a bacteria which is ingested, eaten by the bagworm, very effective, controls over 95% of them, and is really non-toxic to anything other than caterpillars.
Okay. Anything else that you want to pass on to people that either is maybe big in the news or just you're saying, well, at this time of the year, it's something to be thinking about?
Well, it is something that right now we have emerald ash borer that's flying, and you want to be watchful for those. Realize that this is a slender emerald green half-inch long insect. There are other slender emerald green, half-inch long insects out there besides emerald ash borer. But be watchful for them or their D-shaped holes that are an eighth of an inch across in your ash trees. We haven't found them in this part of the state. They are in the Bloomington, Shenoah area. And the big purple traps that you may see that look like big box kites that are about a foot by 2 feet in the trees, these are trying to find out whether emerald ash borer is in the area. Finding those, if the tree is not treated, it's a death sentence for the tree.
Okay. And it's sooner or later, though, it's going to be everywhere, right?
Sooner or later. It's not a matter of if, it's when they will get here. And there are some insecticide treatments that can be used. We don't recommend treatment until the emerald ash borer has been found within 15 miles of where you live because it doesn't move very fast on its own.
Right. But given the fact that it is eventually going to spread, are you really recommending – I mean, even if you had it and you knew that you had it, would there be a point to treat it? Or would you just say, just start thinking about replacing your ash trees with something else?
Well, this is a thing where people make their own decision that way. We lay out the options. The options are that you can treat the tree yourself with low populations of emerald ash borer around for about $20 per tree per year and be a 10 to 12 inch diameter trunk. Having it treated by somebody else, you're looking at $100 to $150. Having a tree removed, you're looking at several hundred to $1,000. Mm-hmm. So somewhere along the line, you may do a combination of I may treat the trees for a while till I decide I'm tired of paying money for this and we're going to cut it down. Certainly, I wouldn't recommend that you would go out and plant much in the way of ash trees unless there are really no ash trees in the area. And certainly, you might even consider if you've got some trees that are starting to grow together, getting a little too heavy, one of them's an ash tree, I think seriously cutting it down, leaving the others.
All right. Phil Nixon, extension entomologist at U of I. Occasionally he's here. We talk about insect pest problems. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.